be gone like the breeze on a warm summer's night. I'll return in your dreams as you move through. It seems to be right. Those dreams so real. You can touch me in the middle of the night.
Peter Jones, welcome to the Jazz Podcast.
Thanks for asking me.
It is our pleasure. It was really interesting to have the opportunity to preview something that exists or soon will exist in the world of jazz that's not an album. Because we've done a few album previews, but this is our first book preview. So tell us what was it that drove you to want to write a book?
First of all, the book is called This Is Hip, The Life of Mark Murphy, and it's about the singer, the late singer of that name. And I myself am a jazz singer. And when Mark died in October 2015, and he said 1915, when he died in 2015, I was just starting to get into him, and I really liked everything that I'd heard of him, and I wanted to know more. So it was that, really, that sort of set me on the path, because I think what made me want to write a book specifically, and because I can remember this very vividly, is listening to Jazz FM. And Jazz FM had always been great supporters.
Is this the DAB version, the like digital radio, or is this an old school?
No, this is from only just a couple of years
back. Right, okay. Yeah.
So Jazz FM, they'd always liked him. But yeah, I can see what you mean. In the previous incarnation of Jazz FM, before...
When I was a kid, I used to drive to school and listen to it.
It turned into Smooth,
didn't it? That's right, yeah, I remember that 100.
So this was pre-Smooth. Was
great.
In the pre-Smooth days, they played a lot of Mark Murphy, and they interviewed him, and they just, you know, were big supporters of his. And anyway, so scroll forward, you know, to 2015, and when Mark died, they, of course, played lots of his tracks on the radio. And there was one tune in particular that they played several times over just the first few days after he died, called Our Game. And it was the most beautiful thing I'd ever heard. And I thought, this is so great. You know, this is another dimension of jazz singing.
Yeah.
In terms of the amount of emotion that Mark was able to squeeze out of that song. And how did he do it?
Yeah.
And I just wanted to know more about him at that point.
All along, we were playing a game, making believe, taking turns, so who's to blame? One by one, we met the fools who've never learned the rules. They play alone and wonder why. When we began, we could roll on with the dice. That freedom, it seems, came along with the price. One by one we met the fools. They ever learned the rules to play side by side. If we'd been aware of what we shared, our affair, how could we dare
than give in to love in one long goodbye.
I went online and, yeah, okay, I'll get a book about it and just read up on it. There wasn't a book. All there was just a few articles I could find scattered around the internet.
Yeah.
Interviews and album reviews and the like. That's all there was.
Yeah.
And I thought, somebody ought to write a book.
Yeah.
And then shortly afterwards I thought, well, maybe I could do it. Because I have written, you know, a couple of obscure books before.
Right.
Not even about jazz, actually.
Oh, okay.
But... you know, I'd had some experience of it, and I thought, well, I'll just look into it, see what happens.
Yeah.
So I went online again, and I thought, well, I wonder who publishes jazz books in the UK. And I came across a publisher called Equinox, who seemed to be the most active.
Right.
And Equinox, amongst other books, have published Simon Spillett's book on Tuppy Hayes.
Yeah.
Which is a terrific read. I don't know if you've read that one.
I haven't read it, no.
Very, very good. I mean, Simon is just the world's expert on Tuppy Hayes, and he did monumental amount of research. So I thought, yeah, that would be a good publisher to go with, and I contacted them, and they were interested, and they commissioned this project.
That's amazing. So how do you reach a point where you were certain that no one else had written a book? Did you keep, like, looking, just in case, you know?
Well, I sort of just took the view that if Amazon didn't have it...
Right, okay.
It probably doesn't exist.
You're probably right.
And even if it does, it probably might just as well not, if Amazon don't have it.
Yeah, yeah.
You see what I mean?
Yeah, so, absolutely. I mean, yeah, like, say, even if there was one, if it's, like, 20 years old, it's maybe not going to be relevant in the same way it can be now.
I'm really, it's between Amazon and Abe Books.
Right.
Who I also use an awful lot.
Yeah. So, Peter, it's a very well-known fact about me that I don't really know anything about, you know, not anything in detail, unless it's like Michael Brecker, you know, then I'm in trouble. And so Mark Murphy, I'm not totally clued up on who this dude is. Can you tell us a little bit about him?
Well, yeah, he was, was because he's no longer with us. He died in October 2015. At the age of 83,
wow.
I think he was.
So,
which is a good ripe old age for anybody involved in jazz.
Yeah, absolutely.
When we think of how many died at sort of 23, 25, 27.
Yeah.
So many greats who died young. Mark lived to a very decent age. Anyway, who was he? He was, in my opinion, the greatest jazz singer there's ever been. And yet... nobody seems to know who he was. If you ask anybody outside jazz, they've never heard of him. And I know this because people have been coming up to me and saying, oh, I hear you're writing a book. Yeah, who's it about? Mark Murphy. Sorry? So nobody knows who he was unless they know something about jazz. And even if they do know about jazz, they often don't know who he was. And I found that very surprising when I first started talking about it to people because... to me, he was so great that it's amazing he didn't become better known to the general public than he actually was. But the more I got into writing this book, I realised why that was. And the reason is that Mark is not as accessible as someone like Mel Torme or Frank Sinatra or Tony Bennett.
Right.
And the reason he's not so accessible... is that he was very much cutting edge. He was very much inspired by instrumentalists as well as by other singers.
Yeah.
And he would try stuff. He made some experimental albums. He did stuff that no other jazz singer would dare to do. You know, he would do, for example, he would do readings from his favourite author, who was Jack Kerouac.
Right.
From Kerouac's On the Road, you know.
Yeah.
He would do very, quite lengthy scat solos, you know. He would clown around on stage. He would sort of lie down on the floor, and he would direct the band spontaneously to do strange things.
Great.
You know, I interviewed one bass player, an expat Brit who moved to Canada, called Duncan Hopkins. And I interviewed Duncan, and he said he was taken aback the very first time he ever did a gig with Mark, when at the end of the very first tune of the night, which was Horace Silver's Senor Blues, he went up and whispered in Duncan's ear, "You take the tune out on your own." And then backed off. And Duncan's going, what do you mean?
I love that. Yeah, he was like, come back here.
Does he mean just kind of play one chorus and finish it there, or does it?
Yeah.
He didn't know what that meant, so he just did a solo,
yeah,
a kind of free solo on his own,
yeah,
for a few minutes. And he said Mark loved it. He could see him standing at the edge of the stage, and he just thought, oh, okay, that's what he wanted.
Yeah.
So I found this out from every musician I spoke to,
yeah,
who ever played with him,
yeah,
that he loved to sort of, it's not causing trouble, but he loved to put people in a spot where they would have to be creative.
Yeah.
And not just do the standard thing.
Yeah.
So for that reason, he also took a sort of perverse delight in when things did go wrong. Because it meant more room for creativity.
Yeah. Yeah. This guy sounds amazing.
He really was. One of the great things about Mark Murphy, whilst I was researching his life, was the way he was so completely obsessed with jazz and being an artist in jazz. Now, that might sound a bit poncy and pretentious, but he took it all very, very seriously, and he never had the slightest interest in making a load of money. He just lived practically from hand to mouth. For many years, he lived in his camper van, he drove himself to gigs in the camper van.
That's fantastic.
And he kept all his charts in the camper van. And as far as I've been able to tell, he lived in it for some 4 or 5 years.
Yeah.
And one of the other people I interviewed was a saxophone player called Richie Cole, who also worked a lot with Eddie Jefferson, the great Eddie Jefferson. And Mark loved his work with Eddie Jefferson, so he got Richie Cole to play on some of his records. And as it happened, I interviewed Richie Cole as well, and Richie said that he too was living in his vehicle in those years. And they used to park. They used to park next to each other on the waterfront in San Francisco. And just have a chat, and then it was, well, good night, and Richie would bed down in his car, and Mark would bed down in his camper van.
Wow.
So he had this sort of really bohemian thing going on.
Yeah.
And as I mentioned it, you know, Jack Kerouac was a great hero of his. The sort of original post-war beatnik, who was a massive, he himself, Kerouac, was a massive jazz fan. You know, he loved bebop, he loved Charlie Parker, and Mark saw himself as part of that tradition.
Yeah.
Where it's not about the money, it's about, you know, being true to yourself, and in his case, being true to jazz. And so, you know, he just saw himself as an artist. He wasn't just trying to be a star. He wasn't just trying to be a big shot or make a lot of money.
Yeah.
On the contrary, he actually passed up several opportunities.
Wow.
To enrich himself.
Yeah.
Because he just didn't fancy it.
Yeah.
On one occasion, he was offered the chance to do an advert for IBM.
Wow.
And all he had to do was a bit of singing. Yeah, he had to get in a plane, fly to Texas, do a day's filming, come back, $100,000.
Yeah.
Who would today turn that down?
Yeah.
But he turned it down because he said, I don't want to do that.
Yeah.
That's not my thing.
Wow.
So anyway, he was great like that. He had this sort of really no holds barred attitude in which the music was everything. But in terms of his singing, he had several great heroes that he had listened to when he was young. The two biggest heroes he had were Peggy Lee and Nat King Cole.
Yeah.
Both pretty sort of mainstream and of course massive stars in their own right at the time. What he particularly liked about both those singers was their understanding of rhythm, because Mark always used to say he was a rhythm singer.
Right.
And he would ride the rhythm, and he loved rhythmic players.
Yeah.
And so for the great part of his career, that was the kind of stuff he loved. He did a lot of bebop-type singing because of those cross rhythms that are going on in bebop all the time, you know.
Yeah.
And when he was a teacher of singers, he always used to say, listen to the drummer. Don't just sing it straight. Listen to what the drummer's doing. He's doing all these offbeats, and he's playing around the kit, and that's how you should think about placing your words in the line.
Yeah.
And that obsessed him for a long time, and he was particularly keen on Brazilian music because of its rhythmic possibilities and its sort of subtle rhythmic variations on what European, you know, purely European or American music was able to do. So he made several albums in the Brazilian style. And then later in life, well, in fact, all the way through his career, but particularly later in life, he became the most wonderful balladeer. You know, he was able to sing sad songs with a sort of power and a passion and a sort of authenticity that I don't think anyone else was able to do. So I just think he had strength in different areas as a singer.
Yeah.
There's really nothing he couldn't do.
Yeah.
Whereas most singers are limited to a certain style. You know, they kind of do medium pace swing.
Yeah.
You know, a bit like England's bowlers in the Test match. And it's very nice and it's very well done.
Yeah.
But it's not exciting. But Mark was just, I think, really thrilling to listen to.
Yeah.
And he would do weird stuff, like he would take ballads and turn them into sort of helter-skelter bebop tunes.
Yeah.
He would always do a song different every night, never do it the same twice running. So it made him unpredictable.
Yeah.
And that is not the route to success. To be unpredictable ain't going to get you a massive coterie of followers who know what they're going to get when they go to see you. With Mark, you would never know what you're going to get.
Yeah.
And he himself wouldn't know until it came out of his mouth.
Yeah.
So you can see why he never became successful.
Yeah.
It's just too much of a wild man.
Yeah.
And that wildness did sometimes translate into indiscipline. Sometimes.
Yeah.
And particularly in the period where, because Mark was gay, and there was a period of about 5 years after his long-term partner died of AIDS, that Mark kind of went off the rails, and you can hear it in some of the stuff that he was doing in those days. He sounds angry.
Yeah.
And he sounds just wild and out of control. And he himself admitted he was addicted to crack cocaine.
Right.
You know, he just went to pieces for a while and then gradually brought it back together. And his career, such as it was, did have a sort of late boost.
Yeah.
And one of the things that relates to his career in England, because he lived here in the 60s for 10 years.
Right.
And then went back to the States. But at some point in the late... let me try and remember when this was. It was about the mid-80s, actually. He was rediscovered by Giles Peterson, the DJ.
Yeah.
And Giles liked him because of the sort of up-tempo bebop-type stuff that he was doing. Because Giles was running these parties, as he called them, sort of dance things,
yeah,
at Dingwalls in Camden and the Electric Ballroom. And he found that the young people, you know, in their late teens, just love this stuff. This kind of old wild man of jazz, you know, his up-tempo stuff. Particularly tunes like Milestones.
Yeah.
He did his vocal version of Milestones. And a tune called Empty Faces, Sergio Mendes' track, with great sort of Latin rhythm to it.
Yeah.
Some of the earlier stuff that Mark recorded in England, with a sort of real great sort of rocking 60s backbeat to it. You know?
Yeah.
All that suddenly Giles had unearthed and started playing it in his at his own DJ gigs. And to coin a phrase, the kids went wild. And so when Mark came back, he was astonished to find all these sort of teenagers coming to his gigs,
you know,
and screaming their heads off as soon as he counted in Milestones.
Yeah.
So he had a tremendous boost.
Yeah.
Personally, and sort of in terms of his own sort of self, you know, evaluation.
Yeah.
So it's just a fascinating story of how his career went through these strange ups and downs and these phases. And even when he was an old man, you know, past 70, he would do recordings with people like, I don't know if you've ever heard of the Five Corners Quintet from Helsinki. A great sort of 60s retro groove type band. Mark recorded tracks with them on two albums that they made then, and they're no longer together. And also there was a Japanese, well, not a band really, they were DJs called UFO.
Right.
United Future Organization.
Wow.
And through Giles, as far as I know, Mark did some work with them. So he was incredibly open-minded.
Yeah.
And he was happy to sort of reprise his old stuff. But he would do experimental stuff. He even recorded sort of his version of rap, you know, when he was quite old.
Yeah.
So he was always trying to push the boundaries and do new and different stuff.
Yeah. Mark Murphy has done so much. How much planning did you go through with drawing out kind of a life story before you actually start writing?
Well, that's a very sensible question. And I wish I had a sensible answer. Because actually now I look back, I can't believe how lucky I was with this project. I'll explain what I mean.
Yeah.
Mark Murphy might have turned out, for all I knew, to be a really dull guy who sort of went into the office every day and came home at night to his wife and 2.4 children.
Yeah.
And lived a sort of blameless suburban existence.
Blameless.
Went into
nothing is my fault.
Went into the jazz singing office every day and came home again. But no, of course he wasn't like that at all.
Mm-hmm.
He turned out to be far more fascinating than I could have imagined possible.
Yeah.
And I was, now having researched the thing and written it, I realised that he could so easily not have been interesting.
Yeah.
And that taught me something about biography as a sort of form in itself.
Yeah.
Because if you've never written a book about another person, particularly another person you don't know, then, you know, you could spend weeks, months researching it and gradually come to the realisation, hey, this isn't a particularly interesting person.
Yeah.
I've been wasting my time.
Yeah.
So thank God,
from
my point of view, Mark turned out to be so interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. How do you go about researching something that there's no books about?
Well, that's, again, a very pertinent question.
Because beyond Wikipedia, I'd be panicking.
Yeah, well, you have to start with Wikipedia, don't you?
Yeah.
Because that just gives you your signposts.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have to sort of, you know, and like we've already said, there are no books about him.
Yeah.
What do you do? So I just started asking around, does anybody know anybody who knew Mark Murphy?
Right.
And it started from that, and you know, I heard about two or three people in the UK who had known him reasonably well or had something to say about him. And each time I spoke to that person, I would then at the end of the conversation say, is there anybody else you can think of that I ought to speak to? And most people would have, you know, one, two, maybe three people that they would suggest.
Yeah.
And so it kind of expanded that way.
Right.
And I ended up interviewing nearly 50 people.
Okay. That's so many interviews. Do you then transcribe them all? Or are you just listening back? I'm just curious to know how you could go from so much interview down to an actual timeline. And then, I mean, it's so much work. So much refining.
The timeline has been quite difficult.
Yeah.
But I was aided by another really major factor, which was I discovered fairly early on that there had been a fan club magazine devoted to Mark Murphy that ran for 20 years. And it was run from here in the UK.
Whereabouts?
It was run from a house in Whitley Bay.
Wow, that's so
in the northeast.
Yeah.
And so naturally, the guy who had run that for 20 years was one of my interviewees. And
yeah.
He had a lot to say about Mark. They were great friends for all that time until they fell out irrevocably.
Right.
But I then was able to, thankfully, track down a guy who had a complete set of all these fanzines.
Wow.
And the fanzine was called Mark's Times.
It just gets better and better.
Mark's Times, it came out quarterly.
Yeah.
And it started out, it was, you know, well, you're not old enough to remember this, Rob. I can see you're barely out of your teens, but there used to be these things called punk fanzines in the 70s. No, of course not. But they were kind of like kitchen table jobs, you know, with scissors and glue and photocopiers. And they would produce these kind of really manky-looking fanzines for sort of punk bands and the like. And strangely enough, Mark's Times started out looking a bit like that.
Right.
Although, you know, without the attitude, you know, it was obviously for grown-ups rather than teenage punk fans. But it had the same kind of aesthetic.
Yeah.
And so Mark's Times was written by its contributors, and not to in any way a professional standard, and nor was it meant to be.
Right.
It was people writing in and saying what they felt about his music and asking questions and, you know, other bits and pieces. So this thing started out as about 8 pages, poorly photocopied and then stapled together.
Yeah.
And circulated to no more than a couple of dozen people. And it was a genuine street level thing.
Yeah.
Great. But it somehow ballooned, and after about 5 years of this thing coming out, it was 150 pages every quarter.
Wow.
Just this massive thing.
So much.
And there were 74 issues ultimately.
Wow.
Before it finished publishing in, I think, I think 1999, I think, was the last one. So anyway, I tracked down the bloke, probably the only bloke in the world who has a complete set.
Yeah.
And one of my tasks was to read through the whole lot.
Yeah.
Because it was great. Mark used to write in.
Yeah.
You know, he wrote little strange pieces himself.
Wow.
And he was interviewed by the magazine on a regular basis.
Yeah.
And that was just gold dust.
Yeah.
And that also, this brings me back to your original question about the timeline, you know, how do you assemble the sequence?
Yeah.
So that's how it happened. Mark's Times was brilliant for that, because although it didn't obviously cover his entire life, it was 20 years of his life.
Yeah.
But there were constant references to his earlier career in there. And I was able to piece together a lot from that.
Yeah.
So you've got all those, and then you've got all the interviews as well. And really, those were my two major resources, as well as just the bits and pieces online and all that kind of thing.
These interviews, would you listen to them, or were they written out?
No, I couldn't possibly transcribe them all. Okay. Well, I could have done, but it would have been a very tedious labour.
Yeah.
So I would listen back to the interview, because I did a lot of them on Skype. I would listen back to them, and then, because I would have recorded them as well, a bit on a device a bit like the one that we're using right here now.
Yeah.
And when I heard something interesting or something I didn't know before or something like that, that bit I would pause it and then I'd write it out.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And start it up again.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
otherwise you can waste hundreds of hours just listening to stuff that might be interesting but isn't necessarily going to make it into the book.
Yeah. So, did you start a first... In my head, I imagine that you get these magazines, you get the 50 interviews, and then you try to create a timeline, and then from that you try to write a first draft about his life. Is that... That's what happened?
That's very astute. Okay. Guess, if it is a guess, that's pretty much what you do, yeah.
I'm making a film at the moment about a trumpet player called Richard Turner, and it's a kind of a very similar process of, like, interviews, listening, timeline, drafting, but it's just like going around in a washing machine at the moment, you know? But so I'm just guessing, based on how I've found this film is creating itself, that again, in a similar situation where I didn't actually know Richard's life particularly well, so there's a lot of personal research going on, which actually leads me on to a question I wanted to ask you, which is about you are going to see people who knew Mark Murphy better than you did. At any point, do you feel any kind of a sense of that people are wondering, like, why are you writing this, you know, and why is, you know, like, who chose you to write? You know, that's the thing, I guess, that...
Well, I chose myself.
Yeah.
And it is, I suppose, a good question to ask, you know, how come I felt qualified? Perhaps that's what's underlying your question. How could I feel qualified to write a book about someone I never even met? Never even saw him perform live, mm-hmm. actually. And yeah, I did wish that I'd found out about Mark earlier and had sort of cottoned on to him and gone to watch him play. But, you know, we are where we are, and I never had that opportunity.
Yeah.
So, I guess on the positive, so that's like, you know, the things that you could say, why do
but
that?
But as you said, you chose yourself.
I chose myself, and I thought, well, what if I decided to write a book about Winston Churchill?
Yeah.
You know, a biography of Churchill, or a biography of John Lennon, or a biography of Miles Davis. I mean, I never met any of those people.
No.
But nobody would criticise a biographer of any of them for writing a book about them. So once I'd sort of thought about it that way, I thought, well, I think I'm as entitled as anybody else to have a go.
Yeah.
Plus, as far as I know, no one else has had a go.
That's the key thing here.
So, and I could sit around for the rest of my life thinking, oh, I wonder when someone's going to write a biography of Mark Murphy.
Yeah.
And nobody ever would.
Yeah.
Or perhaps nobody ever would.
Yeah.
And I just thought, well, I'm interested in him. I've got some experience in this area.
Yeah.
I'd like to do it.
Yeah.
I mean, other people will be the judge of how well I've done it.
Yeah.
But that's... I don't think I needed any more justification.
No.
Than you know, great enthusiasm for him and his work.
Yeah, absolutely. So, how many... I don't know if it's as simple as this. Is it possible to answer, like, how many drafts you ended up doing before you had a finished product?
I probably did at least 4 major drafts.
Okay. And would a lot change in between?
Yes. Usually because as I was drafting it, as I was still getting more information, as I was still interviewing people.
Yeah.
Because, referring back to what you said earlier about, well, how do you put the timeline together? How do you put that historical sequence together?
Yeah.
And, of course, you assemble it in some kind of order. You're going to come across snippets from all sorts of different areas of his life.
Yeah.
And you start that process of sort of putting it into sequence.
Yeah.
And you also don't know what's going to be relevant when you're writing something like this.
Yeah.
You know, you can sort of start writing a section and you suddenly think, hang on a minute, this is actually, I'm writing about someone else.
Yeah.
And actually, it's not that pertinent to the book as a whole. Because I did have a word limit as well. I was told by the publisher that it had to be, I can't even remember what it was now, I think it was about 80,000 words.
Right.
And the my penultimate draft was 130,000 words.
Right.
So I thought, well, I've got to lose about 50,000 words here. But that was, in a way, that was quite good. Because I could really quite ruthlessly chop out all the stuff that rambled on about other people and just focus on the stuff that was relevant to Mark.
Yeah. Do you know why they'd set a word limit?
I presume because they... I don't know, actually.
No, I'm just curious. You know, I'd like to imagine there's something about their market research about the amount of words a reader's going to want on specific... I don't know.
No, I don't know, and I didn't ask because I just thought... Because as a journalist, by training, the first thing you ask is, how many words do you want?
Yeah.
When they said 80,000 words, I said, okay, it's an 80,000-word book.
Yeah.
Off we go.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I ended up with 130.
Yeah.
Chopped out 50.
Mm-hmm.
Got it down to the right amount. But then, you know, there's masses more apart from that because... There's also a discography in there.
Yeah.
The first complete Mark Murphy discography.
Oh, wow.
Which is many, many pages. Because he made something like... I think while he was alive, he made 45 albums.
Right, yeah.
And, of course, there's been a load more since.
Yeah.
So the discography adds to the word count.
Yeah.
Then you've got all the notes. Because when you're writing something like this, you really have to feel confident that what you're reporting about his life is actually true.
Yeah.
And then there's the index after that as well.
Yeah. Did you have a team of people kind of helping you with this filtering, editing? I'd like to imagine this, you know.
I love the idea of I was sitting here writing away with a quill pen with a whole room full of assistants ready to do my bidding.
Exactly.
That's a great
image. Type this up for me, Stevens.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No.
So no. Great. And is there anyone, do you get like an editor or I guess the publisher proofreads?
Yeah, there's an editor who is an American guy. Who runs his own jazz history website, a guy called Tom Cunniff.
Right.
And Tom has been absolutely brilliant. We had a few tussles early on over, you know, things that he didn't think were right and I argued were right. But once we settled down after a week or so, we got on really well and, you know, he was very good about phoning me every day.
Yeah.
You know, with questions or comments or all this kind of thing, and it was great to work with somebody at that level of very fine detail.
Yeah,
you know, if you say this, it implies that. Oh yeah, I see what you mean. You know, okay, well let's change it to so and so.
Yeah. So this book, having been commissioned, does this roughly translate into sort of being like a full-time job for a couple of years?
It's not completely full-time because you have to come up for air occasionally. Also, you just need time to think, you know.
Yeah.
There were occasions where I just had to leave it alone for 2 or 3 weeks and just go and think about something else.
Yeah.
Let it settle down a bit.
How do you feel about the mental stamina involved in working on a project that takes 2 years?
Well, I'm not too bad with the work ethic, to be honest.
Okay.
Once I decide to do something, I generally tend to do it.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I didn't have that whole prevarication thing going on.
Yeah.
And, you know, displacement activities. And I mean, obviously, you get that to a certain extent.
Yeah.
But once I had the bit between my teeth, I think once I'd got Mark's times...
Yeah.
Then I thought, now this is really motoring now.
Yeah.
And I was getting more and more interviews done.
Yeah.
And, you know. And something that occurred to me the other day, actually, was that I could go on and on and on working on this. I could probably carry on for 5 years.
Yeah.
Digging out yet more people, finding out yet more stuff about Mark and his life.
Yeah.
And but then I had a word limit.
Yeah.
So anything else I discovered and wanted to include would involve removing something that was already there.
Yeah. Yeah.
So in a sense, there it is. That's the book.
Yeah.
For all its, you know, possible flaws and
yeah,
what have you.
Fabulous. When is this book out on general sale?
It's coming out on the 1st of March, which is very soon.
Wow, that's super soon. And where will it be? Where will it be available? How can our lovely listeners track down a copy of this? I bet my mum's going to buy this book straight away.
Really? Is she a big jazz singer fan?
Big time. Yeah. She was a jazz singer herself, which is why I got into music. So I have a good feeling about my mum and this book. Yeah.
Okay, well, tell your mum to go straight to the Equinox website.
Great.
And just look for it there.
Fantastic. Does it start in hardback? Is that a thing with books? I don't really know.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's why my guess is they, like, you know, I don't know.
Yeah, it starts in hardback.
Have you got a copy yourself? Have you seen it?
No, I haven't, because I've just...
Your work?
No, I mean, it's all been a bit of a rush lately. I mean, I only finished doing the index a few days ago.
Right.
But everything else was already typeset. Because right. I think, here's another thing, if you want to know the nuts and bolts of doing things like books.
Yeah.
You can do an index quite straightforwardly, because it just means you can go laboriously through the whole book, and every time someone's name appears, or the name of a place, or something that's a theme that might appear, like, you know, vinyl records as opposed to CDs, yeah, for instance, and things like that, you put it in the index, mm-hmm, with its page number.
Yeah.
But of course, the index with its page number changes as soon as it all gets typeset, because you've been typing it out in Word.
Yeah.
And that's all got number, you know, you can number, yeah, your pages in, yeah, Word, but as soon as it gets typeset, all the numbers change.
Yeah.
So I had to do the entire index twice over.
Oh, that was horrible. Wow. What a kick in the teeth right at the end.
Not really, no. It's a self-imposed kick, you know. If it were humanly possible to kick myself in the teeth, I would, you
fabulous
know, maybe.
Self-imposed kick in the teeth. Great. Well, Peter, thank you so much for coming on the Jazz Podcast to preview this remarkable book that you've written. And congratulations for getting it published and another piece of amazing content into the world.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
So strange, why oh why? It could be a true exchange. Why not try love with toe? Is bought and sold. Worth its weight in shiny gold. I won't agree or buy.